Health Policy Open this beautiful March 7th, 2005. And we have a very, we'll start out with an informational meeting on Certificate of Need. Tom Piper is the director of the Certificate of Need in Missouri. He's had 20 years of experience regarding Certificate of Need, which and 4 additional years of community health planning and 8 years of community health services development in other states. He's assisted providers and planning groups to analyze Certificate of Need impact and future directions in Alaska, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Florida, West Virginia, Arkansas, North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Alabama. So he really has a wealth of experience regarding this issue. And we've taken up this issue mainly because Oregon has really been very efficient, but our utilization, Oregon's utilization of hospital services is rapidly catching up to the national average. We have consistently been below the national average, but now our spending has actually increased to 8.2%, whereas the national average is 6.4%. And a lot of our Oregon hospitals, well, have current plans for several billion dollars worth of new construction. And we have good reason to fear that the costs are going to soar, the health care costs are going to soar at an even faster rate in the future. So today we're going to start looking at Certificate of Need. And we're delighted to have Tom Piper. But before I go on, I want to welcome Senator Riley, Representative Riley. He is here. Interested in this issue, and we welcome you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Piper.
Thank you.
And please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Piper. I'd like to give first a special thank you to the Senate Committee on Health Policy for hosting this most important discussion, and particularly to Senator Montes Anderson for inviting me to Oregon's beautiful capital. It's been 20 years since I've been here. And to be able to participate in today's discussions, and to Rick and to Lynn Marie and to Janet Fussell and others who have helped me to prepare for the information today. This is a unique opportunity to share some of the observations that I have gathered about protecting health care interests of our country's consumers. As director of the Certificate of Need program in Missouri, and before that the State Health Planning and Development Agency, it's given me a unique opportunity for over 20 years to directly participate in this regulatory agency. I am also the president-elect and information coordinator for the American Health Planning Association, an affiliation that's allowed me to monitor and to interact with all CON programs in the United States for over 16 years now. I'm here today to talk about how CON relates to healthcare market entry, to competition, and to protecting public interests. Today, I will cover the topics of CON's background, its operations, trends, and successes. I'll also discuss CON benefits from the perspectives of market competition, business concerns, and hospital viability. Of all this information, it has a direct bearing on discussions that you're having about health service capacity regulation here in Oregon. Let's begin by looking at major milestones that have affected healthcare planning over the past century. Almost 100 years ago, medical education changed dramatically when a report by Abraham Flexner closed many schools of what were known as alternative medicine and created regular medicine as we know it today. Some would hold that this was one of the first 20th century challenges to open competition among healthcare providers. By the mid-30s, society was moving toward national health insurance and other programs when President Franklin D. Roosevelt steered legislation into a more conservative Social Security Act. The seeds of publicly funded health insurance had then been planted. Immediately after the Second World War, the Hospital Survey and Construction Act of 1946, often known as the Hill-Burton Act, was passed. The act authorized federal grants to the states to survey their hospitals and public health centers, to plan construction of additional facilities, and to assist in their construction. This step began to rebuild the foundations of the healthcare infrastructure we have in America. After 20 years of infrastructure development, publicly funded health insurance was passed. Medicare and Medicaid became the new platform for federal and state investment in the health of its citizens. Federally sponsored health planning also came of age, and the community demand for public accountability became a national theme known as comprehensive health planning. And as you can see, that was in 1966, the same time that Medicare and Medicaid took effect. Less than a decade passed before the Social Security Administration then connected health care development with reimbursement and empowered the states to plan and regulate accordingly using what was at the time called Section 1122 of the Social Security Administration. With the new authority of the National Health Planning and Resource Development Act, planning and regulation consolidated and solidified into a strong effort that thrived until the early 1980s, and that was 1974 when that happened. And this was then moved aside in favor of a new era of competition at that time. With the move to deregulation, managed care became the popular new tool for competition, using diagnostic-related groups and other payment classification systems to establish purchasing controls. This became the new initiative to reduce costs, improve quality, and assure access. We are again struggling to contain the spiraling insurance premiums, the cost of health care, and to find balance between the promoters of regulation and those who promote competition. Let's look more closely at the genesis of Certificate of Need itself. Based on many years of traditional community volunteer efforts, we saw a cooperative public-private model emerge in the mid-60s. Business and insurance leaders in Rochester, New York, organized the nation's first community health planning council. After affected groups were involved, including consumers, hospital administrators, physicians, insurers, business, and government. Within 2 years, the Rochester model was adopted by the New York State Legislature, and an era of voluntary health planning was born. By 1975, 58% of the states had voluntarily started health planning and regulation. Much of this 10-year effort was also encouraged by the Comprehensive Health Planning Act funding. For the remaining 21 states, Louisiana being the last holdout until about 1990, federal law leveraged Certificate of Need into place by 1980. Now, the chart and the math I'm going to show you in this couple of slides will show how that change has happened and who was affected. On the left, displayed in red bars, are the first 29 states, and they're shown in the list down the left-hand side, that voluntarily embraced regulation. Oregon was among those first dozen states to follow New York's example, which has started CON, and of course that was 1971 here. The solid blue band down the middle shows the 8-year mandatory period for regulation when every state except Louisiana complied with federal law. The light blue bars on the right show the 14 states who terminated CON, thus leaving 36 states, as well as the District of Columbia, who have continued CON to the present time. Now, pay attention to those colors as we move to the map on the next page. And here we show that much of the regulation initiated in the eastern United States, at least voluntarily, and it continues to maintain those programs today. But again, as we look at the color codes, the dark red was an early adopter of CON, and they still continue today. The dark blue came in late to comply with federal law, and they still continue today. But when you look at the light red, might as well be called pink there, was an early adopter who ended the regulation with the end of the federal funding, and light blue states were late in and basically early out of regulation. Interestingly, some of the Northwest U.S. states like yours started early and have maintained your efforts through this entire time. Now, let's see how the regulated states really compare with their efforts. This is an interesting chart that in one matrix attempts valiantly to compare all of the states and how they handle certificate of need. And from this is the very chart, and we are looking at what is currently in existence as of 1 month ago. And there have been no changes within this past month. Down the left column is a list of states ranked by the comprehensiveness of their programs. This rank is calculated on how many services have been reviewed from a list of 30 categories, and you can see those sideways titles across the top. If the intersection of a state and a service is shaded, then that means that that state reviews that service. In addition, on the right-hand side, the level of the reviewability of thresholds for capital investment, for major medical equipment acquisition, and for new service establishment is converted into a weighted average on the far right-hand side. The number of services is then multiplied against that weighted average to come up with the ultimate ranking on the far left-hand side. As you can see, about four states from the bottom, Oregon is one of the least comprehensive states that does certificate of need.
Mr. Piper, can you list, because I can't read what we regulate. I see the first one, long-term care, and then what's the second one?
Long-term care, and the next one would be swing beds, which is a variation on long-term care in hospitals.
Thank you.
I would caution on one thing, that this does not relate to the severity of either the CON program or the decisions that are made within that program. It has only to do with the comprehensiveness. That severity chart is an entirely different one. This matrix has many uses. Policymakers, for example, can also quickly gauge how diverse regulation has become and how they might streamline their regulatory efforts. I remember only 2 years ago, the state of West Virginia, and when working between the health department and the State Hospital Association, attempted to moderate their process and were using this chart as their gauge. The shades of blue originally divided the states into three categories of regulation, with dark, of course, being the most comprehensive. Over the last 10 years, a number of states have drifted down the list as review thresholds have been raised and the number of services has been reduced. The map on the next page easily illustrates the geographic distribution and intensity of this regulation. This is the same map you saw on the title slide of this presentation, and obviously CON regulation remains very popular east of the Mississippi, with only a couple of states, that is Indiana and Pennsylvania, which have terminated their programs in the last 9 years. Against the darker color, the more comprehensive the scope of review, the white states do not have CON regulation. Let's now move on to see how CON's comprehensive foundations, criticisms, and benefits would be discussed. The CON-related activities of over a dozen states, I think, are indicative of what's going on around the country. There have been some very significant developments in capacity regulation just in the last few years. First of all, I'm rather disappointed to report that in spite of many streamlining efforts and legislative proposals over the last 5 years, in Missouri, we haven't made many positive changes. In large part, this has been due to very staggering budget cuts and to massive legislative turnovers that have come out of our term limits that have just come into effect. And I'm sure that this year is not going to be any different than the last couple of years. On the other hand, I've just returned from a state, one of your northern neighbors, who's made many positive strides lately. Specifically, Alaska has a fairly comprehensive regulatory program, which they have just updated to include residential psychiatric treatment centers. This year, they will accomplish a wholesale upgrade of their state health plan, which hasn't been changed since 1984. In order to help out the application process, they are also proposing to eliminate their letter of intent process in hopes that will be able to streamline their activities. But as we go to the far northeast United States, their efforts have been much more stringent. As part of the Derigo Health Initiative, many are now calling for a much stronger CON program, and they were fairly strong in the first place. They also want a larger staff in order to support it.
Mr. McCobian has a question.
Perhaps just Tony could clarify a little bit of what Derigo is for members I'm a little bit familiar with that you might. Could you just explain a little bit what that program is?
Derigo is a fairly comprehensive effort and fairly synthesized through government in order to rebuild their payment programs, to restructure their licensing program, and to integrate it with a stronger planning program. And it is fairly far-reaching. They're looking at what almost become a prepaid system for most activities in Maine. They have expanded their jurisdiction. They've toughened their standards several times over the last few years, in part because of concerns about limited resources and about health care budgets, a concern that seems to be pretty widespread, and I think it's one that you're facing right now as well. Another state that has truly replaced their health planning and regulatory systems would be Tennessee. 2 years ago, after concerns were raised about the integrity of their system, the governor and the legislature worked together to totally rewrite their Certificate of Need program and to establish a new invigorated planning system. And in order to encourage objectivity and broaden their planning scope, this year the planning function was separated from CON into a different department.
Mr. Piper, it says here that this was actually led by the Hospital Association. Why did they see that this was needed?
Concerns have been raised by the Hospital Association and by others that the way in which the CON panel was configured had invited unnecessary and perhaps sometimes inappropriate influence peddling, and that the composition of the state health plan at the time needed complete revamping. The Hospital Association, where they have a number of for-profit and not-for-profit entities in that state and in neighboring states, really took the lead in working with the governor and pointing out that they needed to have planned growth. And it wasn't just in the Nashville area, but a number of other areas as well. And they have actually been advocates of such regulation for a number of years.
Thank you.
There has been controversy growing in another near state where there's been some hotly contested services. Alabama specifically has forces that try to exempt kidney stone busters, otherwise known as lithotripters, but that failed. But they did establish a requirement that CON recipients serve at least 40% Medicaid patients in any of their proposed services, if they were actually get a certificate of need. Last year, they had huge debates about a legislative exemption for a new digital hospital in Birmingham, and that kind of controversy still rages today.
What's a digital hospital?
A digital hospital was billed as a new generation hospital that would have all electronic records, all of their radiology would be centrally located in PACS systems, which is centralized servers and computerized systems, so that virtually everything would be computer-based, very little of it would be paper-based. And so from the moment that a patient walked in the door to the moment that they were exit, every test, every procedure, every encounter would be immediately recorded and would be available to the physicians who would be in charge. Interestingly enough, it is a very interesting title for a movement that's happening throughout most hospitals today. But the way in which it was packaged at the time gave the appearance that it was something that no one else was doing. And therein is the controversy. Now, next door, there are battles that continue on public health interest where we have private versus public interest, and that would be in the state of Georgia. And I've had the opportunity to spend a good deal of time in Georgia, and there'll be a story I will share on this in a few minutes. About 6 years ago, a study by Lewin and Associates concluded that CON was serving Georgians quite well. but battles continue between for-profit and not-for-profit hospitals. It has to do with market share and market entry. They're also deeply concerned about the results of a single specialty, physician-owned ambulatory surgery center exemption, which has ballooned their capacity and raised prices in many areas. This didn't stop a constitutional challenge of CON by their previous attorney general, and it was done on behalf of a physician-owned center. That challenge has failed, by the way.
So you're saying that the way the certificate of need process in Georgia, it did not include ambulatory surgical centers, and so the hospital's challenged?
It's a variation on that theme, Senator. It is a certain kind of ambulatory surgery center. It has to be owned by a physician. It has to be only one specialty, and it might be a certain kind of plastic surgery, for example. Or it might be a certain type of extremities surgery. But it has to be only one specialty. Interestingly enough, and that's been strongly monitored by the Hospital Association, once they came into place, there was not a sufficient mechanism to track how they were being used thereafter. And some of them crept into additional specialties well beyond what they were initially established for. And there's been a continuing set of legal actions that have been going on, largely brought forth by the Hospital Association, pointing out the errors in some of the ways of these ambulatory surgery centers. And as we have looked at statistically, it has done a good deal of harm in terms of apparently excess surgeries as well as very high costs. And the proficiency rate of the surgical teams is going down. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes about in an ambulatory surgery study that's been done. And looking at other states, there have been similar kinds of practices in other states. Virginia's had term limits. And I think that this is a practice in a number of states where you term limit certain pieces of legislation so that unless renewed, they expire. And 2 years ago, the Certificate of Need law did sunset in Virginia, but it has not been discontinued because they've not been able to find a discontinuance plan. Because when you discontinue legislation there, you have to have a plan to do so. And they couldn't get it funded because they, too, have had really strong budgetary problems. Fortunately, they have continued to fund their health systems agencies. Now, health systems agencies are a local planning and review agency that serves just a part of the state. They have 10 HSAs in Virginia. There are only a handful of other states that have these. Ohio, New York, and Florida have retained this particular local model. And efforts to sunset, by the way, have now been abandoned. They have reversed that. And although they actually haven't reinstated new legislation, they've abandoned all sunset efforts, and they're rewriting the legislation, hopefully with passage later on this year. But what they are looking at is a strong impact on the economy and on their budget crisis, and feel that this is one way that the government can retain an oversight role. Now, as I look at my neighbor to the south, which is Arkansas, they've improved their data systems for review, even though their scope of review is mostly home health and long-term care. They've had imbalances in capacity around the state, though, that have led to a lot of debates, most particularly in northwest Arkansas. Some of you may or may not know that this is the original home of Walmart, and it is also one of the largest retirement areas in the state. It is due south of Branson, Missouri, which you may have heard is our music capital in Missouri. There's a very, very large retirement community there. And some of the, there have been concerns that some developers have gotten and held but not used certificates of need in order to freeze capacity and thus hopefully increase the occupancy of their facilities. There are three legislative proposals in Arkansas to resolve this. We're not quite sure how far it's going to go. They've got a lot of debate in front of them. In the far southeast U.S., health capacity regulations have been steadily diminishing. When we look at Florida, Although they've discontinued CON review of all major medical equipment, Florida has repeatedly performed studies which have concluded that CON should be strengthened. It's been an interesting anomaly. In fact, they are right now re-examining the way in which they review new and replacement hospitals. It's probably in response to a national movement, I suspect you've seen this movement as well, for massive renovations, expansion, and replacement of hospitals. Interestingly, last year, Florida went far beyond the federal government's 18-month moratorium on the establishment of what are known as specialty hospitals. These are also sometimes known as boutique hospitals. And they passed legislation to prohibit hospitals of this type in their state. They are the first one in the country to do this. There's a high price that's been paid for heavy deregulation in states, and the one that I would point to is Ohio. 10 years ago, Ohio...
Tell me about a boutique hospital. We have two new hospitals in Lane County, and I'm interested in that designation that was banned in some states. What's a boutique hospital?
A boutique hospital is could almost be called a single specialty hospital. It is a hospital that would be licensed as an acute care facility, but most often they do not have an emergency room. They will be specialized to one kind of care. Will address mostly insured patients. Very few actually address the needs of the uninsured or underinsured. And they tend to be a type of hospital that does not serve the general clientele. It's not a community hospital per se.
I see. Okay.
That, very specialized.
Yeah, that does not apply to what I had in mind.
I don't think you have any specialty hospitals or boutique hospitals in Oregon.
Maybe in Portland they're trying to build one, but...
Interestingly enough, they mostly exist in unregulated states.
Mm-hmm. Now, may I...
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Higginson of the Health Department was the hearings officer at a certificate of need in Lane County that I attended earlier, and he was... saying that the metropolitan area of Portland, I'm not sure if it's a whole metropolitan area, which does not have a certificate of need, is going back to a certificate of need because of infringements by various hospitals on other hospitals' territories, which is interesting. And so there's a lot of change going on in the industry, and a boutique hospital I could see being something that could come along and just take the kind of cream off the top on some in some areas.
Center, that is precisely the language that many use.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
10 years ago, Ohio reduced their health services review over a three-year period, and now they're only looking at long-term care. Today, they're trying to strengthen the legislation to fortify against increasing health care costs. What's happened has been a whole sequence of horror stories, and some of this is on the Internet to be able to see the massive buildups of capacity. But these buildups have been in everything from diagnostic imaging centers to surgery centers to cancer treatment centers, and it's been an explosion. In fact, we've seen nursing homes have been turned into hospitals. We have seen a huge number of MRIs, CTs, PET scanners, and other kinds of diagnostic equipment. We've seen oncology centers that have been mushrooming all over the place. It has just been totally uncontrolled, but there are companies that have really been able to take advantage of that. The legislature is very concerned that a mistake has been made, and they're now in the process of trying to rewrite language to reverse that. And I would tell you,
Mr.
that...
Mr. Berkovian?
Thank you, Chair. Just a clarification. I lived in Texas back in the 80s, and for a while there was a lot of private inpatient psychiatric hospitals. The Attorney General closed them down, and they turned into traumatic brain injury, especially a lot of them just converted. Is this in the same vein of specialized hospitals when they're like psychiatric or traumatic brain injury? Are those considered boutique specialty hospitals? And has that same kind of pattern of hospital change occurred in places like Ohio?
you would see that kind of pattern in other kinds of specialties. Heart surgery, for example, oncology services, very specialized types of cancer treatment. For example, I remember one in Nashville, which was a breast cancer proposal. It was turned down, by the way. But they tend to be single specialty centers of that sort. Psychiatric services don't pay well enough anymore, so they're not attractive. And some of those that are brain surgery, they now expand those into, they may be radiation centers, for example, for gamma knives and this kind of thing. What we, and interesting enough, in Texas, there was an effort 2 years ago to bring back certificate of need for long-term care because there were concerns raised that they have far too many nursing homes, and the long-term care capacity is far exceeding the demand. Other states are also trying to bring certificate of need back. After allowing certificate of need to sunset almost a decade ago, major bills have been filed in both Indiana and Pennsylvania. The former didn't quite make it this past year, but the latter is making major strides after a failed effort to do quality and capacity control through the licensing process. What happened in 1996 is their program sunsetted while there's a debate going on in the Senate about one hospital who wanted to be exempted. It actually passed in the House, did not pass in the Senate, so their CON program expired, and they tried an experiment, which was to pick up the CON program, move it into licensing for hospitals, and do quality control assessment through that mechanism. It did not work well. And in fact, they have now discontinued that effort and are trying to bring back the CON model. And it looks as though they're making some very serious strides in that direction. Now, as we look just a little bit closer, we look at Michigan, who has gone through yet another tough legislative session this past year because they've had a lot of entrepreneurs who've been challenging the system there. They, too, have been struggling with a budgetary crisis. But major business interests have stepped forward to reinforce their regulatory efforts. They were able to demonstrate in black and white how CON reduces healthcare costs for their businesses. And I'm going to spend a few minutes on that in talking about those studies and what they actually had to say. Let me take a moment to point out that it important parts of what I have just told you about have been extracted from an annually updated publication that looks like this. This was just published a couple of weeks ago, and it is a national directory that tracks all the CON programs in the country. I personally work with that through survey methods and whatnot. And it also identifies key information and contacts about health planning, policy, and data, even in non-CON states. The directory is now in its 16th year of publication, and I've maintained frequent contact with all the CON states through this and look at the migration and evolution of their efforts. One of the most important recent efforts that we've been involved in has been the compilation of statutes and of regulations for these states in an attempt to record and compare the review criteria and standards that are being used around the country. As you might imagine, since 1987, when the federal law ended, and there was consistent regulation throughout the country, everyone was doing it in a very similar fashion, that great diversity has happened. People have gone in many, many different directions. And what we try to do is to keep in touch between programs, hopefully to capitalize our collective knowledge and the experience that we have so we're not always reinventing the wheel. Now, let's examine some of the federal activities that have caught attention of a lot of policymakers around the country over the past year. On July 23, 2004, the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice released a joint 361-page report to illustrate its observations and recommendations after holding a conference, holding 27 public hearings, and gathering diverse research over a 2-year period. The executive summary alone was 29 pages long, and of the 250 or more people who testified and some 6,000 pages of transcripts are submitted, the vast majority were actually from disgruntled private developers, from entrepreneurs, from lawyers and consultants who didn't believe that their proposals should be subjected to public scrutiny. These are people who had tried to set up new services in CON states, couldn't accomplish it, and believed that that was really a transgression of their ability to set up new services. Very few public interests were invited to participate. Fortunately, I was one of those who represented the American Health Planning Association in testifying in Washington, D.C. The American Health Planning Association, and by the way, the cover of this report looks like this, and I have some of the extracts here if we want to refer to any of them from that, but the American Health Planning Association also came out with a 15-page report in order to respond to that, and I'll show you why and what is said about that in just a moment.
I'm sure.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Who's on the American Health Planning Association? Who makes that up?
The American Health Planning Association is an unstaffed organization. It's a voluntary organization of public health agencies, of certificate need agencies, of health systems agencies, of private planning entities, and the one glue that holds them all together is a common interest in planning. It is the only national organization that actually represents health planning and certificate of need. It's based out of Falls Church, Virginia. First, the report from the FTC states that its primary purpose as being a movement toward health care as a consumer-driven system, highly reliant on competitive market forces to achieve its goals. To accomplish this, the FTC is trying to motivate restraint in the following areas: CON health planning and health planning, health insurance, public reimbursement systems, interest system subsidies, government mandates, drug price controls, physician collective bargaining, and any other practice that it believes to be anti-competitive. You might note Chairman Morris's statement at the bottom of the slide about the FTC's conclusions, namely that healthy competition equals healthy consumers. Consumers want high quality, affordable, accessible health care, and the challenge of providing it requires new strategies. After 6 pages of discussion about certificate of need, and certificate of need is only a small portion of that entire report, there are less than 2% of this report. They are recommending that provider barriers to market entry be decreased by reconsidering whether CON best serves consumer interests. They further urge the conclusion that CON has not been successful, is too easy to influence, increases costs, and should be eliminated. The report goes on to make recommendations about licensure boards, licensing reciprocity, and 7 other healthcare areas, as well as almost a dozen observations about antitrust enforcement in healthcare. You can download a copy of this report at the website address that you see at the bottom of this slide. Now, there are arguments against these assertions and assumptions, and this is done in a 15-page critique. And let me break it down to the key elements that have come out of the HPA critique of the FTC report. Healthcare, by its very nature, is as much or more art than science and is far from perfect. Unlike food, utilities, hardware, and other competitive commodities, health delivery is a caring, cooperative service industry. The FTC's so-called analytical studies are old and they're unreliable. They ignore many of the recent findings, particularly by recent business real-life experience. And patients are not theoretical economic entities or constructs where healthcare is a privilege described by the FTC model, but instead, we are trusting consumers with a reasonable social expectation. Some would even say a right to affordable, accessible, quality services, regardless of economic standing, knowledge base, or social status. The HP critique can be downloaded from the website that you see at the bottom of of that page. But looking at the next slide, appeared to be one off. I would point out that the FCC report has raised many interesting issues, but it's been hasty in drawing conclusions about how competition can improve healthcare. The FTC's new goals have been integral to community health planning for a very long time. They're not new. They have demonstrated by the planning regulatory processes in most CON states. The difference is in the management of the tension between public benefits and private investment, which tend to be long versus short term, respectively. And we agree that health planning and CON must be periodically reassessed, not unlike what you're doing right here, right now in Oregon. So now let's look at how CON states relate to the usual concepts of competition, as they would be depicted in a free market system. The market has various gaps and excesses, as you can see by the points that I have listed below. Like any business, capital investments are passed on to the consumer, either through charges or premiums or taxes. Competition in healthcare is different because providers control the supply of services. Medical practitioners direct the flow of patients, and therefore the demand for services. Consumers don't have enough information. Consumers are not able to shop for most healthcare, particularly based on price. Where are the price lists to be found? Higher costs create higher charges, as aptly demonstrated by the current double-digit inflation in healthcare insurance premiums. They're notably higher than the medical cost inflex. Unfortunately, consumers are insulated from the specific costs of care, but suffer under the ultimate increased cost in premiums and in taxes. Although reimbursement systems have changed significantly in the last 40 years, the costs of health care continue to escalate, and our policy makers like yourself continue to look for new answers. The conceptual purposes of Certificate of Need can be distilled down to six basic points. The first represents a fundamental tool to implement community health plans. Second, to provide feedback and support to the development of these plans. And then to provide support to planning for health services, for facilities, and for systems. It illustrates an analytical discipline and a goal orientation for all planning. It intervenes in the phenomena of excess capacity generating excess demand. And finally, it helps to preserve precious community and provider capital. Let's look at what's unique about these specific purposes. First, the process is based on sound planning theory. It requires extensive analysis and is driven by objective facts. As an open process, this is one of the few venues where the public is invited to be directly involved. Because the market has gaps and excesses, like the avoidance of low-income populations and concentration of services in affluent areas, CON often negotiates incentives and supports plans to strengthen services. Quality and effective performance are principles central to the development of standards and criteria, and their achievement is often seen through much better applications and fewer denials of projects. Competition in healthcare is very different from other types of products and services, in part because planning and reimbursement establishes target capacities and capabilities for specific areas for which providers compete in terms of charges and quality. CON review is very practical in its approaches to healthcare, and it often teaches potential applicants about health service alternatives and business plan effectiveness, among others. CON criterion standards and CON's responsiveness to the community-based health planning process often redirect resources into areas of greater need. And health providers achieve higher and more efficient levels of performance based on what is good for the community rather than what is good for the provider. Certificate of Need has been criticized since its inception, and the reasons are fairly simple. Many believe that CON only tries to restrain market entry, to lower capital outlays, and to cap technical innovation, all of which are ways to control costs. Critics also believe that CON is more concerned about geography than access, rather than social and system questions. Quality is often a factor that critics say is left out of CON reviews. And the most prevalent claim is that CON regulators neither understand nor react to health service market forces. These claims deserve some specific responses. For example, not only are access and quality concerns often considered more than cost, but equity is an important feature in attempts to improve economic and social access for the community in general, and for patients and providers specifically. CON uses high standards and best practices to help CON review elevate quality. Sound business plans.
Mr. Piper.
I'm sorry?
On the certificate of need in many of these areas, when you're talking about access and quality, we have a number of ambulatory surgical centers going up in the state. And I just want to go back to that question on, with the number of states that you cited, do most of the states have ambulatory surgical centers as part of the certificate of need process?
26 of the 36 do conclude ambulatory surgery as part of their review.
Okay. And do you have any data that shows the difference between utilization in an ambulatory surgical center versus, do you track that kind of data and versus what is used in the
hospital? We do separately. I think I may have a couple of slides that will speak directly to that in just a couple of minutes.
Okay, thank you.
In looking at sound business plans, they're fundamental to the regulatory process. Let me say that again. Sound business plans are fundamental to the regulatory process, similar to the lending principles that are used by community bankers. They're looking for everything from reasonable costs of facility development to competitive charges for procedures, because they too want to assure responsibility and efficiency. There's a couple of other responses that bear repeating. CON recognizes and respects the realities of market forces by involving providers, consumers, business, payers, educators, and others in the development of criterion standards used to conduct CON reviews, thus assuring that real-life practical experience is reflected in this process. By using requests for proposals for needs expressed in health plans, applicants are able to compete on many levels, and CON tries to assure that health facility staffing is open to all reasonably qualified practitioners. On the other hand, CON discourages breaking health services into many segments, or offering services only to those who can afford to pay, or creating practices that exclude other providers, or abandoning communities which are depressed or rural or no longer profitable to serve. Now, while we're talking about practical experience, I want to talk about practical success.
Yes, Senator Morrissey.
Yeah. It's interesting on that particular point, abandoning communities, is there anything that would deny a health care facility from abandoning a community? I know that in some communities that were about to be abandoned, for instance, in Cottage Grove, Oregon, which is right down the road from Eugene Springfield, Peace Health went in and bought the hospital and kept it alive. But is there anything that comes under the public good that would keep a facility in place?
Yes. There are some states, and I don't have the list in front of me to tell you which ones specifically, but there are some states that specifically say that before you discontinue a service, you have to get CON clearance.
Oh.
And that's specifically designed to keep from abandonment of like low-income areas or rural areas or others that are less profitable than the new suburbs.
Yeah.
And we have seen that frequently. I will give you an example in St. Louis, in my home state of Missouri. And it is Barnes Jewish, which is a very large hospital chain there, who has had a large hospital on King's Highway, close to downtown, for many years. several years ago, they reassessed whether or not they should reinvest in the current campus or whether or not they should move west into the new development areas. They went through an extensive certificate need process. They initially went through a $110 million proposal and got it approved to rebuild their current campus, and then came back another year later to relook at that, because after going through the CON process, they found, in working with us, that much of their planning process was episodic. It was based upon what a physician wanted here, what a physician wanted there, what was thought of to be a growth area here, and these were isolated components. When they synthesized their programs together into one, they found that they were able to reduce square footage, improve efficiencies, reduce costs, and came back to us literally giving testimony to the committee saying, thank God for certificate of need. Had it not been for this, we would have wasted literally tens of millions of dollars. Now, that took time. It didn't happen overnight. But they stayed in that community, and they are the largest service provider of the underprivileged and underinsured and uninsured in the entire state of, or entire city of St. Louis. But and they today continue to be cheerleaders for such regulation, if nothing else, to promote planning on a reasonable basis. But it's had many other benefits, and I'll explain a few of those benefits in a moment. Senator, were there other questions?
No, go ahead.
Critics have long used the number of theories and studies and musings to condemn CON. Over the past several years, new evidence from business experience and treatment outcomes has come to light that clearly shows how successful CON has been. The big three automakers have monitored their costs, and there have been outcomes from Medicare health patients that have been reviewed, and ambulatory surgery centers that have been tracked. Here are some of the examples in the next few slides. First, faced with rising health care costs and the possibility of weakening or eliminating Michigan's CON program, the big three automakers undertook several systematic separate analyses of their health care costs in states where they have large numbers of employees and insured dependents. This empirical experience was recorded only in states where they had at least 10,000 employees each and comparable health care benefits between them. Daimler Chrysler Corporation showed that in year 2000, their employees in CON states of Delaware, Michigan, and New York enjoyed health care costs which were up to 164% lower than those in non-CON states, which were Wisconsin and Indiana. Daimler Chrysler also cited and endorsed the experience and views of other business organizations, including the Leapfrog Group, that CON regulation also helps to ensure quality by assuring procedure minimums and promoting higher average program volumes for many health services. Let's look at another automaker.
Now back to that other slide. When you say that states with certificate of need, their health care costs lower, are we comparing apples to apples? One of the first slides you showed, there are a number of different entities that are required to have a certificate of need. Were these states pretty similar in what they required to have, or some of these states have more requirement or more things that need to get certificate of need?
New York is perhaps your broadest program. In fact, it was the flagship of a certificate of need. And yes, you will see that their costs are lower. Michigan was not too far behind in its comprehensiveness. In fact, if we were to go way back to that chart of the matrix, you would see that they're fairly high in the comprehensiveness of the program. And Delaware is just a few services behind that.
Right.
So of their base services and acute care services, they're all the same.
Okay.
And then there's some extra things like home health, components of long-term care, some specialized equipment that are slightly different and keep building one upon another. But the simple answer is yes, in comparability.
Okay, Representative Riley.
I noticed that there are four states with certificate of need on their map and three without, and you only compared part of those. Well, what about Missouri and Ohio, which are noted on your map but not on your chart?
What I should have pointed out there is that, let's see, it's one, two, three, that particular map actually represents all of the auto worker studies. But Daimler Chrysler does not have plants in every one of those states. The other, Ford and GM do have in the other states. So what I'm doing is I'm showing all the states that are affected by the automaker studies.
Mm-hmm.
But these five specifically were just for Daimler Chrysler. That's where they had their big plants.
Thank you.
Let's move on and look at another automaker. This particular one is General Motors. They analyze their health care use and expense data among employees and dependents in Indiana, Michigan, New York, and Ohio, four states where it has large numbers of insured, and they looked at it for a period of time from 1996 to 2001. During this time, Indiana had been without CON regulation for many years, and Ohio had just repealed their acute care portion in 1995. Comparisons show that GM spent nearly a third less in CON states for health care expenses per employee than in non-CON states. GM noted that with over a million employees, it spends $4.2 billion each year on health care benefits for its employees, retirees, and dependents. In interpreting its experience, GM stated, quote, "Some argue that deregulating health facility expansion will trigger free market forces of supply and demand and lead to lower costs. On the contrary, General Motors has not found that to be true based on our vast experience in states that have varying degrees of CON regulation." In fact, I do remember that it was GM who said that the cost of health care as a portion of their production costs for a vehicle were higher than the cost of steel, and that it was really threatening their competitive ability against foreign automakers. And this is also being said by Ford, and we have a large Ford plant in the St. Louis area. And let's talk about their experience. Ford Motor Company, they had a report that included Kentucky, Michigan, and Missouri as the CON states, and Indiana and Ohio as the non-CON states. In certain respects, the Ford study is broader than the GM study in that it distinguishes between inpatient and outpatient hospital costs, as well as service-specific costs for magnetic resonance imaging, usually known as MRI, and coronary artery bypass graft, which is a type of surgery sometimes called CABG. When comparing inpatient and outpatient costs for their hospital costs, Ford found that CON states came in about 20% lower than non-CON states. Now, the results of other studies are equally persuasive, as I'll show in this next slide. When we compare Ohio and Indiana against Michigan for MRI and CABG services, healthcare costs were found to be anywhere from 11 to 39% lower in CON states. In summarizing its study, Ford stressed the consistent correlation between CON coverage and lower costs across a wide range of different services and settings. Ford's analysts believe that the failure of academic studies to document the cost benefits of CON regulation is because of the inability of such large, imprecise macroeconomic studies to account properly and adequately for the many confounding factors that were otherwise effectively taken into account by Ford. Now let's look at ambulatory surgery charge nationally. SMG Solutions, a national surgery monitoring organization, collected charge data showing that ambulatory surgery center charges in CON states were over a quarter lower than in non-CON states. Obviously, business and others are concerned about money and about the bottom line. So their illustrations are about lower health care costs. Elsewhere, the concern is more about saving lives. The importance of program service volumes and their connection to CRN regulation has been demonstrated recently with the publication of a nationwide study of Medicare patients that documents statistically significant lower mortality rates for CABG surgery patients receiving treatment in programs in states that regulate open-heart surgery under CON. These University of Iowa research authors note that most CON studies have focused on whether CON has affected capital investment and healthcare costs, and that few have examined directly the relationship between CON regulation and quality. After analyzing the experience of over 900,000 Medicare patients 65 years of age and older between 1994 and 1999, they concluded, among other things, that, quote, CON regulation is associated with better patient outcomes. Thus, repeal of CON regulations may have negative consequences on patient outcomes, end quote. Now, they've also definitively shown, again, comparing the results of CON states to non-CON states, that mortality rates were found to be lower, over 20% lower, in CON states, including my own state of Missouri. Critics of CON regulation are reluctant to acknowledge this connection, but there are few mechanisms other than community-based planning and CON regulation that systematically promote regional service programs and minimum patient volumes. Obviously, these practices save lives. Which brings us back to where we started. That is that unrestricted healthcare competition has some serious consequences. First, it splinters the provider delivery network, which causes staffing shortages, and in turn lowers quality and fragments the healthcare support system. Secondly, it threatens safety net facilities, such as trauma centers, medical education institutions, and low-income neighborhood facilities. It creates high-profit niche markets, such as specialty hospitals, we spoke of that earlier, and outpatient service centers in areas such as diagnostic imaging, ambulatory surgery, and radiation therapy. As the publication Hospitals and Health Networks said in its review of the 1996 Dartmouth Atlas, quote, supply generates demand. Let me say that again. Supply generates demand. Putting traditional economic theory on its head, areas with more hospitals and more doctors spend more on healthcare services per person. And speaking of hospitals, let's now look at a recent hospital association story. CON can protect community provider interests, as you'll see in the following video.
Century and more, all across the state, Georgia's community hospitals have been the cornerstone of our healthcare system. Most of us were born in a community hospital. We've been to their emergency rooms for minor injuries, broken bones, and worse. We've sat with loved ones admitted for surgery or treatment for major illnesses. In rural areas, small community hospitals serve as a first line of defense and provide local residents critical access to healthcare services. In major metro areas, Georgia's community hospitals have developed into leading-edge institutions, providing care unsurpassed anywhere in the country. Together, these hospitals and the tens of thousands of physicians, nurses, and others who keep them running sustain a vital statewide trauma network, train our future doctors and nurses, and absorb hundreds of millions of dollars in charitable and uncompensated care provided to uninsured Georgians each year.
The community not-for-profit hospitals in the state face many, many challenges today. One thing that we all may take for granted is that our local hospital will always be there. And that is just not the case.
A key reason for the degree of stability Georgia's hospitals do have is that the state has maintained a rational regulatory system to ensure the availability of healthcare services, known as Certificate of Need, or CON. This system was established in Georgia in 1979 as part of a federally required effort to hold down healthcare costs.
Certificate of Need all revolves around, number one, to add a new service to a facility, you have to demonstrate that there's a need for that service. You have to demonstrate that you can provide the quality of care. You have to demonstrate that you can provide the quality of care at affordable prices, and that you can demonstrate that you can serve the medically indigent population also.
The federal government dropped its CON mandate in the 1980s, and since then more than a dozen states have abolished their regulatory systems. Georgia so far has maintained its CON system. But the Georgia legislature is regularly pressured to weaken or repeal CON. Financially driven for-profit hospital companies and physician groups wanting to build ambulatory surgery centers often make an appealing case, talking about choice and competition in the marketplace. But in recent years, more and more data has come into focus supporting the case for regulated healthcare. In 1996, for example, the American Medical Association published the Dartmouth Atlas on Healthcare, the most comprehensive study ever of the U.S. healthcare system. It found, unequivocally, that in healthcare, excess capacity leads to higher costs without any indication of improved quality. The Wall Street Journal summed up that report by saying, in healthcare, supply often dictates demand, rather than the other way around. More recently, the Florida Hospital Association found in a comprehensive national study that open-heart surgery mortality rates are an astonishing 21% higher in non-CON states. And now businesses are starting to understand that healthcare deregulation can hit them right on the bottom line. When the Michigan legislature recently considered a bill to repeal the state's CON system, Daimler Chrysler, Ford, and other major employers analyzed the impact. What they discovered was striking. Healthcare costs were dramatically higher in states that had repealed CON. As just one example, Daimler Chrysler found that its per-employee healthcare costs were nearly three times higher in Wisconsin, which repealed CON, than in New York State, whose CON system is intact. Closer to home, a new study by one of the nation's leading healthcare finance experts found that inpatient and outpatient hospital charges are substantially lower in Georgia than in Texas and Arizona, both fast-growing Sunbelt states that dropped their CON requirements in the 1980s.
When industry looks at this state, they look at the healthcare system. They look at what type of healthcare is being provided to that local community where they're going to locate. It's the only way that some of rural Georgia has a chance of recruiting industry.
As post-CON experience comes into focus in the states that have abandoned it, lawmakers, business leaders, and others are questioning the wisdom of deregulation. In Missouri, after deactivating parts of its CON system at the end of 2001, healthcare costs soared. Now the state's business and hospital communities, including both for- and not-for-profit hospitals, are mounting efforts to reinstate CON. In Maine in early 2002, the legislature was asked to abolish CON, But after studying the potential effects, lawmakers instead passed tougher regulatory requirements. More and more policymakers are coming to understand just how complex and delicate the state's healthcare system is, and how even well-intentioned actions can destabilize that system, impacting businesses, and most important, undermining hospitals' ability to deliver vital healthcare. While advocates of deregulation claim they want to give consumers a choice, the reality is that abolishing CON could well deprive them of any choice at all when it comes to neonatal services and other vital but very expensive and unprofitable hospital services.
You know, the average citizen out there is like, yeah, I want choice. We all want choice. But you're going to pay. You're going to pay for that choice. If you take certificate of need away, then you have to ask the question, who's going to take care of the indigent care? Who's going to provide the medical education in the state?
Today, community not-for-profit hospitals provide 100% of medical education in the state, as well as hundreds of millions of dollars in uncompensated care to the indigent and the working poor, including the uninsured and the underinsured. Community not-for-profit hospitals have only been able to do these things because of a strong certificate of need law.
Community hospitals do provide almost every service available to them, regardless of whether that service generates profits or not. Unlike a for-profit chain, to give you an example, neonatal intensive care. You know, when the for-profits come in and they want to deregulate certificate of need where they can deliver babies, they're not also asking that you deregulate neonatal intensive care. Why? It's very expensive, but we provide exactly the same service to that baby unable to pay as we do to that private paying patient.
I'll just remember how he basically fit in my hands when he was born, and it's just been amazing to me to see all the resources that are available here and all that they can do for these little micro preemies. You know, we are very fortunate that we live here and got sent to this hospital. It's a blessing.
There's more to health care than profits. There's a commitment and there's a service that comes with serving that community, and that is to provide good quality health care to all citizens of that community, regardless of their ability to pay. And that, I think, is the story of community not-for-profit hospitals. We're there, we're stable, and we do a good job. I think that speaks in volumes about who we are, what we do. That's why I'm passionate about it, because I know in my heart we're doing the right thing.
Yeah, there's a significant responsibility placed on a community hospital to provide those services not only to the indigent, but also to the private care patients.
The patient is the most important person at the hospital.
No one is immune from cancer or from heart disease or from any other ailment.
Everybody's great, you know, all the nurses, and they make you feel welcome, and not an outsider. We go a lot of places and people are looking and staring, and here it's just kids, grandkids, and doctors taking care of them.
It only takes an experience of having a loved one to go to your community hospital to understand how important that hospital is to that community. We a lot of times take our hospital for granted that it's going to be there. Well, it can't be there if we do not do at the state level what we need to do in order to help that. And that is a good, strong certificate of need law to make sure that it's a viable institution in that community.
This video was produced by the Georgia Alliance of Community Hospitals, as you saw, which is an organization of about 60 of Georgia's not-for-profit hospitals, as part of their effort to protect public input.
Mr. Piper, Oh, okay. That's fine. We have one of the chief sponsors of the bill here, and I was going to recess you to get him in, but he likes hearing what you have to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, no. So
one slide and...
No. Keep going. He's being educated.
Anyway, basically, they put this effort forward to protect their public input and accountability in their state. And what they were looking at was really bringing balance between regulation and competition. And they wanted to be able to protect the public interest. They wanted to do it by promoting the development of community-oriented health services and facility plans. And that's a lot of what we're talking about here. Because we want to be able to provide pricing and quality information to consumers so that they have an educated choice. And to provide a public forum to ensure that, above all else, the community has a voice in healthcare. This, I believe, will protect the public's interest. So this completes my discussion of certificate need experiences and trends. I hope it's answered some of the questions. I'm sure it's probably raised a few questions. The American Health Planning Association can be contacted through the information at the bottom of this slide. I would also point out that Missouri's slogan is shown at the top of this slide as it applies to Certificate of Need. And my contact information can be shown at the bottom. This has really been an excellent opportunity for discussion about Certificate of Need and market entry. And I feel very privileged that I've been included in your examination of these issues. I have some information which I believe, Rick, you have probably already made a copy of. There's other information that we have on our internet website that would perhaps be helpful. And most particularly, I think if you ever need information, feel free to give me a call or contact me. But again, thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you, Senator. And be happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
Or yield the floor, as it were.
No, he says to keep going. Right. I have a couple of... when you have the Certificate of Need process, and there's such a vast difference between our rural hospitals and our urban hospitals, particularly in the amount of money they make, what are the Certificate of Need processes quite different for hospitals in the rural area as those compared in the urban area?
In some states, they are very different. They will have a specific set of criteria and standards just for rural hospitals compared to urban hospitals. And philosophically, they differentiate because those tend to be sole community providers in small communities. They're it for all practical purposes. Where in large communities, there is a broader choice of healthcare institutions to be able to go to. But more importantly than that, they have a much broader range of services. Rural services tend to be more subsistence services, so what you're trying to do is to guard and protect the minimums. And that is what is often how the criterion standards is written, is to make sure that there are minimum numbers of beds, minimum types of services, minimum criteria for keeping open, like the emergency room and that kind of thing. So there is differentiation between them. In Missouri, we do not differentiate rural from urban as criterion standards, but when we examine those, for example, critical access hospitals, we, believe it or not, have a number of remote areas, particularly in the southern part of our state, in the Mark Twain Forest area, in other wooded areas, in our lakes areas. And in those cases, we look at some of the things such as the 15-bed minimums to be able to protect the capacity there, to make sure that they have basic surgical services, basic emergency services, basic lab services, and those kinds of things. So the motivations tend to be different, and the attractions are different. You don't have a lot of entrepreneurs trying to go into rural areas or underserved areas.
Senator Morissette.
Well, I asked a question earlier related to what you're talking about now, and the example that you gave me about keeping a hospital open in an area of need was an urban example in St. Louis. And I guess my question was more in the vein that you're speaking of, a small, rural, isolated healthcare provider. Now, in your experience in Missouri, do you with a certificate of need, they need to have a certificate of need to leave that small rural area? Are you saying that there has to be some minimum facilities left behind? Is that what you're saying?
In Missouri, we do have a statutory provision that says that we must be notified, but no longer requires a certificate of need to discontinue a service. Somewhere midstream, about a decade ago, that was tweaked. We used to have a time when it required approval to discontinue a service, but that has changed. We do have some very interesting things. For example, recently HCA proposed to replace two hospitals in Independence, which is a suburb of Kansas City, with a single, much smaller facility. The new facility would be located 4 miles from one and 8 miles from the other facility. We went through extensive public hearings, debate, public input, and other things in order to examine that entire issue, because the people who were 8 miles away were very, very unhappy because they felt that their community was being abandoned. And what came out of that, and I'm not going into detail now, but what came out of it was basically a negotiation that would leave behind primary clinical services and transportation services such that the first need would be met when someone has an emergency, and if it can't be, the emergency transport can move them right away. Had it not been for the CON process, that never would have happened.
I see.
But that's what we mean when we talk about negotiation. Sometimes we're able to sit down and say, to get from point A to point B, perhaps we need to find a different road. And
yeah, that's an interesting negotiated solution. That's good. Thank you.
We've used that as well for services like lithotripsy. Mm-hmm. We've had a mobile lithotripsy service that would go from hospital to hospital and have a number of hospitals share one service. Worked very, very well.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much does it cost to operate your Certificate of Need program in Missouri? How many FTE are involved, and where does the money come from?
We have a budget of $197,000 and some change. I have a staff size of 3.5 FTEs, myself included. We generate revenues in excess of $600,000 a year in fees. So over three times the amount in fees than we have in actual expenditures. And our fee rate is lower than yours. It's 0.1% of the project cost.
Okay, I guess Madam Chair is asking because there's no fiscal impact on this bill, and it seems to me there should be.
Any other questions at this point in time? Do you want to just stay there, Mr. Piper? And I'm going to just recess the informational hearing, or close the informational hearing, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 503, and I would like to, and you may stay there, but invite Senator Ben Westland to speak.
For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and I very much appreciate being able to watch parts of your presentation. I guess I could save a lot of time here and just say ditto, thanks, I'll take any questions. But I think the film, and indeed this bill, obviously the chief sponsor, I am here to support Senate Bill 503. This is a difficult issue. Let's not fool ourselves, and there will be many arguments made on both sides of this issue that have some clarity and some degree of validity. And it really revolves around one of the great benefits of American medicine and the American healthcare delivery system, one of the great benefits and the great, great cost drivers of those systems. And that's redundancy. in a simple, and I don't mean to be trite, but in a simple phrase, it's kind of the question, we're arguing the question of, you can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. And in some of my recent medical trials and tribulations, I can assure you, it was not only of medical benefit, but also personal and economic and convenience benefit for me to be able to walk across the street to get some of my treatments, literally walk across the street from the Capitol here, as opposed to have to get in my car and drive to another location, obviously, probably Portland. There was economic and medical benefit in that redundancy of service delivery. But there is also cost, which after a point, I don't think that's a societal cost that we as the people of Oregon, or indeed America, should end up having to pay. Again, we can have anything we want, and that anything needs to be good enough. But we can't have everything we want. A lot of people have characterized this bill as being anti-hospital. And I can assure you that I am anything but anti-hospital. I mean, they've only saved my life 3 times in the last 2 years. I love hospitals. And I mean that reverently. But at some point, you've got to evaluate what are the economics, and a lot of that comes down to patient mix. A couple of the committee members were asking questions about rural hospitals, rural areas. This isn't such a problem in rural areas. They're struggling to hold on to docs. They're not worried about sticking a new hospital or a new oncology or a new heart institute. They're worried about holding on to what they have. No, this comes in larger metropolitan areas where different categories of patient, different geographics of an area produce a more favorable and profitable patient mix.
Yes, Senator Merrick.
Thank you. The question that I asked earlier was in the context of a hospital leaving a rural area, and the explanation was there had to be, in at least some states, a certificate of need approval to pull out, and without leaving anything behind. Now, that wouldn't work everywhere in rural Oregon, but in some places it might. So that was the context in rural areas and a certificate of need. So.
Well, I misinterpreted your question, but we're making the same point.
No,
part of this issue is having dollars available in the healthcare delivery system to sustain some of our more rural and distressed areas, as opposed to enlarging capacity in urban areas. And that's one of the things I am very concerned about, and one of the reasons I support this bill. The other issue is this just doesn't center around hospitals. I mean, there are other medical capacities included in this bill. And I use my own community of Bend as an example. And one of the fastest growing areas of utilization, the CT scan. We have 3 CT machines in our St. Charles Hospital. And I remember the somewhat anxious occurrence when I used it the first time and having a modicum of understanding about healthcare costs as I was being wheeled in. I noticed we have 3. And I thought, boy, now there's a waste of money. And I got my CT scan. I didn't think too much about it again. 6 months later, I'm in there for an emergency CT scan. And you know what? 2 of those were being used, and that 3rd one looked pretty damn good to Ben Westland about it that time. And so I think it's very justifiable that that capacity be centralized. What's shocking to me is that after this I learned Bend has not only those three in St. Charles, they have four scattered throughout the community as it is currently populated, and by 2008 are expected to have another four CT scans come into our community. This is one of these things where I'll bang on lawyers for a while. It's, you know, if you go into a one-horse lawyer town, if a second lawyer comes in, legal fees quadruple. They just don't double. Part of this centers and feeds on itself. And we as Americans, I think, being ever more mindful and more sensitized to healthcare issues, will continue utilization of these new miraculous technologies at a far greater rate than is necessary and our ability to pay for them. I'd just like to close with a comment that I alluded to earlier. A lot of this is patient mix driven. Bend is a perfect example. These machines, these facilities, whether it be hospitals or MRIs, CTs, they're going to where the dollars are, not necessarily where the medical need is. That's the key. That's the foundation of this bill. It's not anti-hospital. It's not anti-anybody. But it is very pro trying to sustain an ever fragile healthcare delivery system. I appreciate you allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Yeah.
Senator Morissette.
I'm going to go back to that same area that I talked about earlier in rural Oregon. If you have a health provider who wants to leave because there's not enough money there, would your certificate of need require any kind of negotiation to leave or any kind of alternative site be set up by anybody? I mean, are people just going to be able to abandon an area because they don't have enough, they don't make enough money and nobody else is willing to come in? What do we do in that case? Now, that was related to certificates of need in other states. If you're going to withdraw services, that's as important as putting excess services in. So does this bill work both ways? If you're going to withdraw a service, do you have to pay attention to who's going to step in?
To my reading of the bill, Senator, fair question. I think this highlights a very legitimate need. But to my reading of the bill, and I stand to be corrected if someone has a different opinion, we don't address that side of the equation. What we're trying to get at, so there is additional dollars available through whatever subsidy mechanisms or whatever to help hospitals, medical facilities, clinics stay in given areas. At the end of the day, it does come down to the almighty dollar. But yeah. It's that clear.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Senator Westland, thank you, Madam Chair. How did you settle on a figure of $1 million?
With regard to what?
In regard to the trigger.
I don't know the specific decision-making process that went into that. I'm sure I can get...
The reason for the question, Madam Chair, I mean, it says you have to go through the process, and $1 million or relocating are the triggers. And I guess I'm wondering, I mean, in a hospital to do any construction or virtually anything, $1 million is reached very easily. And so, I mean, if you wanted to add a patient wing, you're gonna do that. And so I'm just wondering if this isn't, to a degree, more micromanagement than you had intended.
I that's a fair comment. But at the same time, capacities added or not necessarily prevented, but to be examined and scrutinized do need a threshold. I'd be happy to work with you on establishing that threshold if you think that's too restrictive. And I don't know if there was any thing in the any discussion of that in the bill summary, which
there was no documentation. We are going to go into a formal public hearing tonight, and that may we may answer that this afternoon or late early evening.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, it looked to me like a low threshold that may. I mean, that part of the reason for the question is how much does this cost the state to administer this, and with that level of threshold, my sense is that the administrative cost would be way more than what might be anticipated, just because that would pretty much cover any activity any hospital attempted to undertake.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I could look forward to working with you on this that particular aspect and your support of Senate Bill 503, Senator.
I didn't say I supported it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Courtney.
How much does CAT scan cost? Dice.
Having a great deal of familiarity. It depends on the dyes and the markers, the enhancers they're using, whether it's chest, abdominal, or total body, but it's anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000.
I mean, I don't mean the test. I mean the
machine. Oh, the machine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That I can't answer on. This is coming from dusty cobweb-filled memory banks, but I think they're right at 900,000 or 1,000,002.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morstead. Okay.
On our trip to Sumter in eastern Oregon, they have an ambulance service. They have EMTs and two ambulances, which they support with a bake sale every year. Are there any instances where states, maybe we're talking about socialized medicine here, but are there any instances where states are very concerned about lack of health care in a particular community and require that someone provide some care? Now, I guess you could put a safety net clinic in there somewhere, but I guess this is an ongoing concern of mine, that you have a place, you know, that Sumter is in the middle of, you know, 75 miles in either direction, and they do provide ambulance service and EMT basic services. But Mr. Piper, that's a question to you about any other states.
The Senator, yes, that is addressed, but not as a certificate need issue per se.
Okay.
It's a larger issue of a state health plan. And if you allow me for a moment, let me look at the broader issue. As you look at certificate of need and its original establishment in 64 and as it became federal legislation in 74, it was based on the premise of having a state health plan in each one of the states, and that plan would be a cooperative effort between all the parties and all the stakeholders, whether it's a provider, whether it's a payer, whether it's consumer groups. This would be an agreed-upon document, and that would establish within it goals for every part of the state. And it would address emergency medical services needs. It would address where the needs are and what the capacity should be. It would then, as a second stage effort, look at ways in which to make that happen. One way to make that happen was simply to promote it as a voluntary effort. Failing that, a second method that was used was called developmental dollars or plan development. And it would actually be seed money, pilot projects, things of this sort, fundraisers, diversion of federal funds, other techniques in order to put money into the establishment of those services. And then thirdly, failing all else, certificate of need was a way in order to focus those resources and to encourage existing resources to expand into those areas. So it was really stepwise, but it started with the state health plan. Mm-hmm. And it went by many names, strategic planning and other kinds of things. But it was a implementation tool, and that's what certificate of need was originally supposed to be, was an implementation tool. So, yes, it happened, but it happened in a slightly different way. And once upon a time, you had that tool here in Oregon as well.
Any other questions? At this point, yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore keeps going back to the rural issue and the rural size equation. And I applaud you for doing it. We need to do more there. But part of this, like I said when I first sat down, is, you know, this is a difficult issue. And it, again, the little cliche, I mean, you can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. That applies on the rural side, too. It's... Anyway, thank you.
Any other discussion? Okay, at this point in time, I would like to recess the public hearing on 503, and we will continue it at 5:30 this evening right here in Hearing Room B. And then after we have public hearing, then we're going to go back to informational hearing where we will actually have Tom Piper from the Missouri Certificate of Need Program, Jim Walton from the Southern Coos Hospital and Health Center, and Bruce Bishop from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We'll have a panel discussion on Certificate of Need. With that, I recess the public hearing, and that's it.